This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, the show where we try to get Malaysians to know more about the federal constitution and their constitutional rights. So the history of Malaya's emergence as a sovereign independent nation after centuries of colonial domination is a story with such a wealth of perspectives that it can be told and retold in many ways. So believes my guest today, Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Haji Syad Salim Faruqi, who is the holder of the Tunku Abdul Rahman Chair at the University of Malaya. And he's going to join me now to sort of dissect how we actually made the Supreme Law of Malaysia and, you know, everything that came with it, all the different changes that have come to the Constitution. Prof is here to explain all of that with me today. Welcome, Prof. How are you today?
Thank you very much. And good afternoon to all your listeners. I hope everyone is doing well.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Prof. So, of course, Law and Behold is a series that we do in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar, the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law, and the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights. So, Prof, you know, we're starting a new sort of a new direction this year, you know, for this series, and we want to look at the history of the federal constitution, right? So I know it's a tough one, but we're going to try and give a sort of a brief and summarized history of the formation of the constitution today, Prof. And I know that when negotiations for independence began in Malaya in the early 1950s, the British colonial government set a host of preconditions to ensure a smooth transfer of power from the British to the locally elected political representatives, right? And one of them was the promulgation of a constitution that was acceptable to the locals. So there was then a constitution drafting body, right, that came about. And that was, we know that they're named or they are called the Reid Commission. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Before I answer your question, let me just mention this to you, Juliet, that all constitutions have to be understood in the light of history. At the same time, and here lies the great challenge, though the constitution must reflect the realities of the past, it must at the same time hitch itself to the stars. It must be aspirational. It cannot simply be an echo of what happened in the past. It has to take note of the tides that are washing up at the shores, the new tides. So in our country too, of course, in the mist of time, there were many Malay empires, but we are going to skip that. Let's come to the era 55 to 57, when there was self-governance.
Okay.
There was a Federal Legislative Council. And as everyone knows, at the 1955 election, 51 out of 52 seats were won by the Alliance. Now, that gave the Alliance a tremendous inspiration to negotiate with the British from a point of strength for full independence and sovereignty. And therefore then a Reid Commission of, actually it was six jurists who were appointed, but one from Canada was unable to attend.
Okay.
First of all, there was Lord Reid, a British judge, distinguished judge. He was the chairman. Sir Ivor Jennings, a British expert on Commonwealth constitutional law. He had also taken part in the drafting of what was at that time Ceylon's constitution. Sir William Meckell, former Governor General of Australia. Malik, a former High Court Chief Justice from India. And Justice Abdul Hamid of the West Pakistan High Court. I'm sorry to report to you, Juliet. First of all, there were no women on the Reid Commission. I know you won't like that. I don't like that either. Mm-hmm. And there were no locals either.
Yep.
So this was a commission of outsiders. And many people ask why it was done like this, why there were five total outsiders. I can't really answer that adequately because as we were talking about earlier, history. It's difficult to be objective about history.
Okay.
History is a tale told by the victors, mm-hmm. or tale told by those who have the power to record things down. But the normal arguments, the general arguments given are this, that outsiders would be in a better position to be objective, to give to the new draft constitution a universal or international flavor of constitutionalism and rule of law, something that perhaps the locals may find difficulty, because it's a fact, all of us are encapsulated, E-N-C-A-P-S-U-L-A-T-E-D, encapsulated. We live in a capsule of time, space, territory, religion, race, gender, profession, etc. So outsiders could perhaps give better objectivity. But then I think the more important issue was this. The colonial masters, the British, the Malay rulers, the alliance, and the other stakeholders. There were other stakeholders. There were, for example, the Islamic group that wanted a more Islamic content in the constitution. The other stakeholders, they could not agree on their nominees. And as such, it was decided that it will be a commission of five outsiders. And perhaps this should be accepted for the reason that though the commission was of outsiders, it was given terms of reference. Mm-hmm. It was not free to do as it likes. The terms of reference were to make recommendations for a federal constitution, not a unitary constitution, with parliamentary democracy, a bicameral or two-house legislature at the federal level, a strong central government, safeguards for the position of the Malay rulers, common nationality, and safeguards for the special position of the Malays and the legitimate interests of other communities. Now, the UMNO MCA-MIC Alliance drew up a 20-page memorandum for the Reid Commission. And very significantly, half of the memorandum dealt with the communal issues and the need to cater to Malaya's dazzling diversity. So the commission was not free to import British, American, and French concepts. No, I think it was acting under strong terms of reference. So on most issues, the Reid Commission showed deference to the ethnic compromises negotiated by the communities. In fact, it held 118 public and private hearings, 118. Wow. Between June and October 1956, this must be incredible. You know, mm-hmm. June, July, August, September, October, 5 months, it held 118 hearings. It made its recommendations on 20th February 1957 and submitted a draft constitution.
Okay.
So I think that's the brief history of how the constitution was drafted. It was partly autochthonous, that's the word we use, that it reflected indigenous features. At the same time, there were lots of lessons borrowed from India, from the UK, and even some from the USA. It is not very well recognized, but in many respects, the Malayan constitution was a reflection of many provisions of the Indian constitution. Mm-hmm. And though, of course, the British parliamentary, what we call the Westminster system, was borrowed. But there were lots of very indigenous features. For example, 9+1 Malay rulers, 9 state sultans, plus they get together and elect from amongst themselves a young Di Pertuanagong. Now, that's quite unique indeed, isn't it?
Yes.
Not one, but 9+1 rulers. But that's because that was Malay history.
Okay. We're just going to go for one quick break, Prof. But when we come back, we're going to find out more about, you know, what the alliance actually, what some of the important positions that they took and, you know, what happened once the federal constitution was established. I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Haji Shad Salim Faruqi. He's the holder of the Tunku Abdul Rahman Chair at the University of Malaya. It is another episode of Law and Behold, and we're looking at the history of the federal constitution of Malaysia. We'll have more after this quick break. You're listening to Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today is Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Haji Shad Salim Faruqi. He's the holder of the Tunku Abdul Rahman Chair at the University of Malaya. We are exploring the history of the Federal Constitution of Malaya in this series. And this series is, of course, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar, the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law, and the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights. So before the break, Prof, you sort of gave us a history of, you know, the Reid Commission and how we sort of came to what became the federal constitution, right? So we know that at the stroke of midnight on the 31st of August, 1957, the federal constitution was established upon the Declaration of Independence, of course. So as it stood in 1957, what were some of the core principles of the federal constitution? You know, what did it provide for? What would you say it was founded upon?
Yes, the Reid Commission submitted its report on 20th February, 1957. Mm-hmm. So a few months before Merdeka, and it also drafted a draft constitution. The draft provided for the following main characteristics. Number one, a supreme constitution. Now, this was very important, Juliet, because in the country of the colonial master, there is no supreme constitution. Mm-hmm. Parliament is supreme. Right. But we rejected that. Instead, we have a supreme constitution. The other alternative was to go back to the historical reality of supreme Malay rulers. That also was not accepted. The third possibility was to adopt Islam as the basic law of the land. That too was not accepted. Instead, we adopted Article 4, Clause 1, which says, this constitution is the supreme law of the Federation. And any law passed after Merdeka Day, which is inconsistent with this constitution, shall, to the extent of the inconsistency, be void. Number two, if you have a supreme constitution, you need a referee, an umpire, to blow the whistle on those who play fast and loose with the basic law. Mm-hmm. So we have provisions for an independent judiciary with the power of judicial review. Thirdly, we had a federal system. Our country, even during the British days, actually, was in semi-autonomous separate regions, the federated states, the non-federated states, and that was preserved. So there was a federal system, but with a very heavy central bias. Mm-hmm. Number four, we adopted the Westminster system of parliamentary democracy. Unlike the American system, where the president does not sit in the Congress, in the parliament.
Yeah.
He's quite independent, whereas our prime minister and cabinet are part of parliament. Then we have a constitutional monarchy at both the state and federal levels, but with special protection for the rights of the Malay rulers. So there is some special protection. They are constitutional monarchs, but they have some special rights where they have discretionary powers. There are partially entrenched fundamental rights. I say partially entrenched because fundamental rights are subject to the extensive power of parliament. Then there are provisions for subversion and emergency. Our constitution was born in the shadow of the communist insurgency.
Right.
And that dark, long shadow of communist subversion was actually reflected in our Articles 149 and 150. There is protection for Malay special position, but there is also concomitant protection for the rights of other communities. There were liberal rights of citizenship for all persons born in the Federation. Surprisingly, Malaya was very liberal, jus soli, the right to citizenship by birth was accepted. But very soon after that, in 1962, jus soli was removed, and one had to have ancestral links with the land.
Yeah.
And I think there were linguistic, cultural, religious rights for non-Malays. I wish to say this with the, both happiness and a little bit of sadness because people don't recognize. In many other countries and constitutions, the melting pot ideology is employed. In other words, everyone submerges his or her personality into one big hole, one big melting pot, and acquires some overriding characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
In Malaya, on the other hand, our forefathers accepted, instead of a melting pot, a mosaic. Political parties, religious organizations, cultural organizations, linguistic organizations were allowed to preserve their culture, their language, their religion, their music, their songs, their foods, their dresses. And what was sought to be accomplished was a unity in diversity. It was fully accepted that unity does not mean uniformity. And I think that was, to me, one of the greatest achievements of our forefathers. I have said this on other occasions, Juliet. I think Tunku Abdurrahman Putra Al-Haj and his other colleagues from MIC and MCA, I think they deserved a Nobel Peace Prize. not because they ended a war, but because they created conditions for peace. And I think one of the reasons this country is, compared to many other Asian and African societies, it is so much more peaceful, so much more harmonious, it is because there was this mosaic approach adopted rather than a melting pot. So I think the Constitution was it was a document with many flaws, but at the same time, a fabulous amount of compromises, compassion, negotiated compromises were achieved. And I think that's why the Constitution has survived 64 years now.
That's right. But of course, you know, we've seen changing political, economic, social circumstances, right? And those, of course, have created the need to amend the original contract. Am I correct? Some would argue for justifiable reasons. Others have been a bit more controversial.
Sure.
Has the Constitution been amended significantly since 1957?
Of course. There are about 40 constitutional amendments that have been passed. And I'm going to say something to you that you and your readers may be quite surprised about. Though the number of amendment acts is 40 or so,
mm-hmm.
the number of retouches, the number of amendments to specific articles comes to about 675.
Wow.
Sometimes one article was amended many, many, many times. So if I look at the Merdeka Constitution of 1957 and look at the Constitution of 2021, which was the last amendment for the rights of Sabah Sarawak, number of times each article has been given a new touch, a new color, whether a nice, soft, gentle color or a blazing red color, that I don't know. it's about 75 times. Now, as you correctly said, many of these amendments were absolutely necessary. So we began with 54 MPs, then we increased to 96 and 104, 124, now 22. In 1963, Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore, nearly 880 articles of the Constitution had to be amended. And then Singapore was asked to leave. Again, new amendments were made. Federal territories were created. So these are basically harmless, or these were inevitable amendments. But what is sad is that in many areas, the amendments have posed a challenge to constitutionalism, to rule of law, to human rights, and to the idea of a parliament that should be the grand inquest of the nation, a parliament that makes the executive answerable, accountable, and responsible. So may I just give a few examples, Juliet?
Of course.
In 1957, the country had 11 states, 9 plus 2,
yep.
And each state sent 2 senators, so 22 senators, indirectly elected by the state legislatures. So 22 indirectly elected senators, and there were 16 appointed senators. But the state senators were in a majority. Now it is 26 state senators and 44 appointed senators. So the 2/3 of the Senate today is appointed by the Yandi Parthonego. I think this was a significant, drastic departure from the idea that the Senate would be a chamber of the states, would be able to block any constitutional amendment that violated the rights of the states. But the present situation is the Senate actually, nearly 2/3 of the members are appointed by the Yandi Parthonego. In 1957, the Election Commission had the power to draw up these constituencies. But now the law says the Dewan Rakyat has the power to reject them. So the Dewan Rakyat now is totally in charge of the electoral boundaries. Mm. The Election Commission merely recommends. The ultimate power lies with a political body. And as we all know, the government dominates the House. So therefore, basically, the redrawing of the lines is in the hands of the government. Emergency powers have been stripped of most of the checks and balances that used to exist. Mm-hmm. For example, in 1957, if emergency is declared, then if Parliament is not in session, it shall be summoned to session as soon as is practicable. That provision was removed. So when emergency is declared, if Parliament is not in session, Parliament can be kept away from being called to session for as long as we want. In 1969, there was no Parliament for 22 months. So emergency powers, federal-state relations have made the federal government much more powerful in relation to the 11 Malay states. In 1963, Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore were given some ironclad guarantees. I'm sorry to report that some of those guarantees have either been taken away or some of them are not being observed. The judiciary suffered drawback in 1988. They amended Article 121, Clause 1. Before that, the law said the judicial power shall reside in the courts. Mm-hmm. So whatever you mean by judicial power, and one can write a PhD thesis on that point, what is meant by the word judicial power? It resides in the courts. They amended that to say the court shall have such power as is conferred on them by the federal law. In other words, if federal law gives a power, the judges have it. If federal law takes the power away, the judges don't have it. So I think that's what we in constitutional law call violation of the basic structure of the Constitution. There are many other such changes that were not so wholesome from the point of view of rule of law, a separation of powers and constitutionalism. But to me, the bigger problem is not that the law was changed. The bigger problem is that there is lack of legal literacy, something that you are trying to overcome through these programs. And I congratulate you for that. there is lack of legal literacy. And worse, there is lack of constitutional patriotism. Mm-hmm. Even those who know the Constitution say, I support it, as long as it promotes this view. But if the Constitution promotes a view that I don't like, then I don't support the Constitution. So the Constitution has not become the chart and compass, the sail and anchor of a nation's endeavor. Not only legal literacy, constitutional literacy is lacking. Constitutional patriotism is sadly lacking. And that's very, very serious indeed. In the civil service, mm-hmm. in the cabinet, in parliament, there is no constitutional literacy.
Yeah. I think many Malaysians just think that's something lawyers need to know, and they don't think that they need to know it, or law professors such as yourself. Just carrying on from, you know, what you said about all those changes that you mentioned, right? You've also said before that these fundamental alterations to critical areas in the Constitution have resulted in the dilution of the spirit of the original Merdeka Constitution. Would you like to elaborate on that statement for me?
Yeah, I already said something about that just now. So, for example, we had one of the finest judiciaries in this part of the world till 1988 or so. And then this amendment came, the sacking of Tun Saleh and two other brother judges came. And now actually the judges are supposed to do what Parliament asks them to do. So I think the amendment to Article 121, Clause 1 was unfortunate. And it has been more than 30 years now, the judicial winter has not yet thawed, if I may put it that way. The judicial winter is still there, but I have to say with some satisfaction that there is now a fairly large number of judges who are asserting themselves for promoting the rule of law and separation of powers and upholding human rights. But the judiciary is deeply divided. There are currents and cross currents, and time will tell. But I want to end this point on a note of optimism. We are only 64 years old. Mm-hmm. And in many, many other countries, it takes much, much longer, actually, for the courts to give life to the law. Take the USA, for example, a constitution of liberty. Everyone says a constitution of liberty. But right up to the mid-60s, the blacks were treated so badly. Then actually, after Kennedy's death, the Civil Rights Act, which he was trying to sponsor, was then sponsored by Lyndon Johnson. And of course, before that, the courts had given decisions like in Brown versus Board of Education, saying that discrimination against the blacks was unconstitutional. So it takes a long time. But I think we are moving in the right direction. Hopefully, the judiciary will restore the Constitution to the pedestal on which it was placed when Malaya began its tryst with destiny.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Haji Shad Salim Faruqi. He's the holder of the Tunku Abdul Rahman Chair at the University of Malaya. It is another episode of Law and Behold, and we're looking at the history and, you know, the formation of the Federal Constitution of Malaysia. We'll just go for one more quick break, and when we come back, we're just going to talk about one or two articles in particular. Keep it right here on Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me today is Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Haji Shad Salim Faruqi. He's the holder of the Tunku Abdul Rahman Chair at the University of Malaya. And it's another episode of Law and Behold, where we try to get everyone to know more about the Federal Constitution and our constitutional rights. We're trying to promote constitutional literacy, of course. And this series is an ongoing collaboration with the Malaysian Bar, the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law, and the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human rights. So before the couple of breaks, Prof, you did explain how it came to be the federal constitution, you know, all the different amendments that have been made, what's good, what's not so good. I'd like to bring up one article in particular, and that's Article 153, which, you know, just to summarise, grants Malays special rights and privileges, right? And often we hear the term, quote-unquote, social contract in relation to this article. Maybe you can help expand on that. You know, does the Constitution explicitly refer to a social contract and all of that?
The words social contract are actually famous words of political science, and they have a very different meaning from the one assigned to them in Malaysia. Social contract in political science refers to the understanding between those in power and those who are governed, between the governors and the governed, that the governors will act in the interest of the governed, and the governed will therefore give loyalty to the governors. So it is between the root, those in power and those who are the subject of this power. That is a social contract. So the legitimacy of those in power depends on their willingness and on their execution of the trust that they must uphold. In Malaya, some politicians have used the word social contract to refer to the negotiated compromises between the Malays and the non-Malays, the rulers and the British, and the rulers and the alliance. I have no objection to these words, as long as we understand that these words do not occur in the Constitution specifically. Also, Juliet, Article 153 doesn't use the word privileges.
Okay.
It says special position.
Okay.
Special position of the Malays, and later on in 63, the natives of Sabah and Sarawak. So my answer to your question would be, the word social contract do not occur anywhere, but clearly our constitution is replete with negotiated compromises. For example, citizenship was granted not on the basis of race or religion or region. It was open to all. The electoral process is open to all, except for the Yang di Pertuan and the rulers, the nine Malay rulers. No other federal position is restricted to any particular race. Technically, any office other than the Yang di Pertuan Agong and the nine Malay rulers is open to all. All this talk we hear that such and such position is only for such and such race, this is not in the Constitution. And I will not be surprised if in 10, 20 years' time, a MP from Sabah, Sarawak holds the cards to forming the government and is given the position of the Prime Minister of the country. Article 153, Juliet, special position of the Malays and the natives of Sabah, Sarawak, is a negotiated compromise. You know, it also says special position of Malays and the natives of Sabah, Sarawak, and the legitimate interests of other communities. Mm-hmm. Secondly, in Article 153, Clause 2, there are words like Yang di Pertuan Agong shall reserve such proportion. Proportion means not 100%. Proportion. As is reasonable. So the word reasonable occurs. As is necessary, the word necessity or expediency occur. So Article 153 is fairly broad-minded, and it's a matter of its interpretation. There is nothing to prevent the government of the day from reinterpreting 153 to make it needs-based rather than purely race-based. One could say many more things about Malay reserve land, about freedom of religion, but actually time is a problem right now. All in all, I think our constitution walked the middle path of moderation, of compassion, of compromise. It gave to everyone something. It gave to no one everything.
What a good way of putting it, Prof. And I think we need to remember that. You always say, you know, in all our episodes that that you've been on, that it's one of the best sort of models, you know. It's a model of, it deserved the Nobel Peace Prize for preventing a war from happening, isn't it? And of course, as you've laid out, you know, it is the law of laws for us. And you know, you've said that before. And you also mentioned earlier that there isn't sufficient constitution literacy in Malaysia. I guess, you know, why, you know, just before I let you go, Prof., what would you say to people listening about why they must be literate about our constitution and why it's so important for us as Malaysians?
Well, as I said earlier, the constitution was a carefully negotiated compromise. It had many imperfections, but I think it contributed significantly to Malaysia's spectacular economic prosperity, its racial and religious harmony. Even today, Juliet, there may be group tension, but at the individual level, there is so much friendship. Look, during the floods, people went out to help each other, irrespective of race or religion. There are Malays, Muslims, who went out to clean temples. Now, I know there were some who criticized. There were people of one religion going to the place of worship of another religion and trying to help out. There's a great deal actually in this country that is beautiful and that needs to be revived and resurrected. So that's one factor. Secondly, why should we obey a constitution? Well, I think that's the issue of constitutionalism. In the olden days, as long as you had a benevolent dictator, that was good enough.
Yeah.
But these days, we don't think like that. These days, we say it should be a government of laws and not of men. And it's not a government of laws. It's a government under the Constitution. The law must be under the Constitution. Unlike in England, where there is no written constitution, or New Zealand, where there is no written constitution. It's not enough for those in power to be under the law. The law must be under the Constitution. So I think this is it is a step towards a higher stage of civilization, that we live by the law. We live by the law where it helps, and we live by the law even where it hurts. We can't pick and choose. We must live by the law. Of course, the law is, as you correctly mentioned earlier, the law is open to change, but the change must come in accordance with the law itself. So I think constitutionalism, rule of law, human rights, these are to me an indication of a developing civilization. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Prof, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Haji Shad Salim Farooqi. He's the holder of the Tunku Abdul Rahman Chair at the University of Malaya. And he was laying out so beautifully, you know, how our federal constitution came about and why it is such an important document for all Malaysians to know about. If you miss any part of this conversation or any previous Law and Behold episodes, you can always search for the podcast at bfm.my/learn, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.